Gateway Market and Cafe is Des Moines' locally owned grocery and specialty food store, centrally located at ML King Parkway and Woodland Ave. Enjoy chef-crafted prepared foods, artisan baked goods, organic produce, hand-cut meats, local and international cheeses, wines, and craft beer. Gateway's Cafe is open for dine-in, carry-out, and delivery service 7 days a week. Stop by or visit gatewaymarket.com for more details. Gateway Market, good food, great community. Welcome to the Fallon Forum, folks. Ed Fallon with you here today. And thanks to our sponsors, including Gateway Marketing Cafe. Gateway is Central Iowa's premier good food store and brings together the world's finest products with Iowa-grown foods and passionate personalized service. If you're looking for quality foods with a community focus, check out Gateway Marketing Cafe. Thanks also to Central Iowa Realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land. Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses like Ritual Cafe. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. Hey, a quick shout out to the Des Moines Irish Session for providing our bumper music. And if you're at the Iowa Irish Fest, we'll see you in 2 weeks in Waterloo. They'll be there. We'll be there. I'm part of them. Hey, before I talk about the situation in Gaza, another matter of serious concern. Every year for over 30 years here in Des Moines, there's been a commemoration for Hiroshima Nagasaki, the two nuclear bombings that occurred back in the 1945, 3 days apart, August 6th and August 9th, I believe. This year, the commemoration is on August 7th. Yeah, that event will be at the Japanese Bell on the west side of the state capitol. And rain location is Capitol Hill Lutheran Church in Des Moines. Okay, so this is a difficult conversation. Last week, Kathy and I were invited to join a couple friends of ours for lunch. And one of them is a guy I go way, way, way back with. We go back to the 90s. And we've known each other a long time, had good rapport. And, you know, I was not prepared for this conversation. I had no idea this was going to happen. One of the two friends had said something about concern about the Democratic Party. And I said, yeah, maybe Mamdani will, you know, help bring a different perspective to the party. And they were just rabidly opposed to Mamdani. I says, what's going on? Well, we're pro-Israel and pro-Zionist. And it kind of caught me aback. I said, well, you know, I get being pro-Israel, but pro-Zionist, you know, that to me means anti-Palestinian. And I think there's various definitions. And I looked up several definitions of Zionism. And one is a nationalist movement focused on establishing and supporting a Jewish homeland in the historic land of Israel, also known as Palestine. It encompasses the belief that Jewish people have a right to self-determination and a state in the ancestral homeland. That right there is pushing it, because, you know, that's already home to somebody else. And we've seen what's happened since 1948. And I don't dispute that Israel has a right to... let me put it this way, that Israelis, the Jewish people, have a right to exist. And in their ancestral homeland, that's great. It should happen living in peace with the people who are already living there and have been living there for thousands of years. Anyway, the conversation did not go well at all. I almost felt like leaving. I mean, this is a guy I've been with friends for a long, long time. No matter what I said, well, what Kathy said, relevant to the horrible situation in Gaza, the destruction of so many lives, of an entire, 70% of Gaza has been destroyed, the infrastructure, including hospitals and schools, and 800 plus people have been killed just trying to get food. No matter how we try to bring about our concern about that. It was always, well, bring it back to the hostages. Yeah, isn't it terrible how the hostages that remained are still being treated? Well, yeah, it is, but that's not, that doesn't negate the reality that so many people, and again, a third of the people killed in Gaza are children. You know, and we tried to bring up some of the evidence supported by video, supported by conversations with people on the front lines, discussions in the media. And they just basically just say, well, that media doesn't count. It was basically like Trump. But these aren't Trump people. You know, these aren't Trump supporters. They're basically saying, look, if it doesn't agree with, if it doesn't concur with our narrative, and our preconceived narrative is that Israel has a right to that land, and that if there's any genocide going on at all, it's the Palestinian people who are trying to commit genocide against Israel. Which to me is remarkable. I mean, one of them even went so far as to accuse the UN of helping to orchestrate the massacre that occurred on October 7, 2023. That was a new one to me. And any sympathy for the Palestinian people, in their eyes, was deemed to be anti-Semitic, if I understood them correctly. And I have a hard time seeing myself as an anti-Semite. I mean, my major at Drake University was religious studies, and the emphasis was on Hebrew. I learned the language. I read texts of the Hebrew Bible in the original language. That became, I had a lot of my studies focused on Judaism. I went to all the synagogues in Des Moines, all three of them. Nearly every time I'm in Boston, I visit the Holocaust Museum or Memorial, which I find very moving. I've watched many a film about what happened during the Holocaust, my favorite being the one featuring Al Brody called The Pianist, because it combines not only my concern about genocide, in this case of the Jewish people in Germany, in Poland, but also my love for Chopin and a brilliant rendition of part of the G minor ballade. But, you know, it seems like anti-Semitism is a word thrown at anybody who disagrees with the Zionist vision of an Israeli state free of the meddling of Palestinians. And I mean, we've even seen AIPAC, a very, very powerful political arm of the Zionist movement that has defeated Jewish members of Congress because they were talking about peace. You know, so I was really thrown for a loop. I think if I'd been prepared for that conversation, maybe it would have gone differently, maybe better. But I didn't expect that these people I'd known for a long, long time, like 30 years almost, would support what's going on in Gaza, would support the IDF, would consider that anybody who was critical of that to be anti-Semitic. So as I record this program today, Monday, July 21st. I'm reading this morning that the Pope, Pope Leo, has condemned the war on Gaza as barbarity. And the Pope issued that statement in response to the 93 Palestinians killed this weekend by Israeli gunfire while waiting for food. And I don't even know why this is news anymore. It's happening every single day. Every day, people trying to access food are being gunned down by the Israeli military. What is it, like 850, 900? I've lost count. People actually killed. And then another, 4,000 or 5,000 who have been wounded? You know, it's clear to me that there is really no interest in providing humanitarian aid in any substantial and truly helpful way to the struggling people of Gaza. I mean, the Biden pier, if that doesn't go down as one of the biggest boondoggles in American history, I don't know what. I'd like to see the rest of the list. I mean, the pier that, I can't remember the price tag now, the millions spent to quickly build a pier on the Mediterranean Sea, allegedly to bring aid to Palestinians, a pier that failed miserably and was abandoned within, less than 2 months. You know, and then, of course, we have the Israeli Defense Force preventing aid trucks from getting to people in need. And so that provided the justification for forming the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which is a private effort controlled by Israel and supported by the U.S. And those are the only entities that support it, the U.S. government and the Israeli government. And back in May, when the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation just got started, the U.N. and also a bunch of leading relief organizations that had worked in the area said they would not cooperate with the entity. Because, and I quote from their statement, it, quote, contravenes fundamental humanitarian principles. And the UN and these aid agencies also warned that this approach to delivering aid could, in fact, deepen the suffering of the civilians who are already facing severe shortages. And that has sure turned out to be the case. I don't know how you look at what's going on and not call it genocide. I don't get that. I don't know how you look at somebody like me or all the other people, somebody, not the Pope, who say that this is a problem and call us anti-Semitic. Is the Pope an anti-Semite? I mean, maybe some people would say yes. But I'm pleased that there are more and more Jewish voices that are speaking up for peace and speaking out against genocide. And one that I read about recently that really inspired me was Omar Bartov. He's a professor of the Holocaust and genocide studies at Brown University in Rhode Island. And he wrote a piece for the New York Times recently. It was titled, "I'm a Genocide Scholar. I Know It When I See It." Now, Bartov grew up, in his own words, quote, in a Zionist home. And he also lived the first half of his life in Israel and even served as a soldier and later as an officer in the Israeli Defense Force. And he has spent most of his career researching and writing and teaching about war crimes and the Holocaust. And I want to share some of the content from his New York Times editorial. He said, by May of 2024, the Israeli Defense Forces had ordered about 1 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah to move to the beach area of the Mawasi, where there is little to no shelter. And the army then proceeded to destroy much of Rafah. Basically, they emptied the city so they could level it. You know, and at that point, says Bartov, it was no longer possible to deny that the pattern of IDF operations was consistent with the statements denoting genocidal intent made by Israeli leaders in the days after the Hamas attack. And that's a good reminder, folks, right? Because after the, again, horrific, indefensible, you know, war crime committed by Hamas against the Israeli people, then it resulted in the death of, what, over 1,000 and about the same number, I suppose, being taken hostage. I can't remember the exact numbers. But Netanyahu said he promised that the IDF would turn parts of Gaza, quote, into rubble. He urged Israelis to remember, quote, what Amalek did to you. As Bartok points out, that's a quote that many interpreted as a reference to the demand in a biblical passage calling for the Israelites to, quote, kill alike men and women, infants and sucklings of their ancient enemy. You know, that's pretty harsh. You know, Israeli government and military officials said they were fighting, quote, human animals. They later called for total annihilation. Nassim Vaturi, who was the deputy speaker of parliament, said that Israel's task must be, quote, erasing the Gaza Strip from the face of the earth. How is all that not a call for genocide? How is all that not a call for totally destroying a people? You know, and clearly, again, when you look at some of the deeper intents behind Zionism, the intent is to occupy that space for the Jewish people. That and the West Bank and the Golan Heights and some interpretations I've read of Zionism go even further, down to the Nile, to the Euphrates, into Lebanon. I mean, this is an imperial force. I mean, I am a frequent critic of my own government. And I refuse not to be a frequent critic of other governments that are doing horrible things in the world. And you have no right to call me or anyone else an anti-Semite because we call what's happening a genocide. You know, so Bartov, it's a great piece, folks. You ought to read it. You know, he goes on to say, you know, according to a recent investigation by Haaretz, and Haaretz is a Jewish publication that has been critical of what's going on. According to Haaretz, an estimated 174,000 buildings have been destroyed or damaged in Gaza. That accounts for up to 70% of all the structures in the Gaza Strip. And so far, more than 58,000 people have been killed, according to Gazan health authorities, including more than 17,000 children, who make up nearly a third of the total fatality count. More than 870 of those children were less than a year old, and more than 2,000 families have been wiped out. In addition, 5,600 families now count only one survivor, and at least 10,000 people are believed to still be buried under the ruins of their homes. I mean, I don't know if I ever want to talk with my friend about the situation in Gaza again. But if I did, if I'd come more prepared, I would have additional information, data, numbers at my fingertips. I mean, I've got some of it in my head, but again, it was not a comfortable situation. You know, and again, I don't know how you read this any other way. The Pope, leading Jewish authorities on genocide, the UN, nearly every nation in the world. I mean, the BRICS nations, Brazil, China, India, Russia, South Africa, and now actually that BRICS also now includes, I guess they need a new acronym, needs, let's see, it includes Egypt, Ethiopia, Indonesia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. It's a growing force in the global south, and to some extent north, that is now they're calling for a unified Palestinian governance under the Palestinian Authority and for the complete withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza, as well as the release of all hostages and detainees held in violation of international law. The BRICS states express grave concern over Israel's continued military operations in Gaza and the blocking of humanitarian assistance, strongly condemning the use of starvation as a weapon of war. And Brazil's president says the world must act to stop what he describes as an Israeli genocide in Gaza. You know, what really troubles me more than anything, or maybe not more than anything, but as much as anything, you know, again, I've always had great concern for what happened to the Jewish people back in World War II. It has always appalled me. And I mentioned earlier how drawn I have been to the Holocaust Memorial in Boston and how drawn I was to learn more about Judaism, to learn Hebrew. And to see Israel doing to another people what was done to it, and let's call it what it is. You know, it's not gas chambers, but it's wholesale destruction of a people and their infrastructure, their home, their culture. I mean, the goal is to destroy the Palestinian people. And, you know, if the goal was just to wipe out Hamas, well, you would have maybe responded and then quit, because obviously it's not going to work. You haven't wiped out Hamas. In fact, what Israel might be doing is empowering another generation of radicals who hate Israel so much that they embrace those kinds of tactics. There is no military approach to solving this conflict. It has to be done through diplomacy, through a focus on peace, dialogue, give and take, compromises. It has to come to that, and it should come to that sooner rather than later, because right now so many people are dying and so much suffering is going on, and it's not conscionable. And again, I'm just blown away by the people I sometimes meet, and once in a while, a friend who doesn't see it this way at all, because I can't. There's plenty of room for disagreement on a lot of things, but you can't look at Gaza and say, that's okay. What's happening there is okay. You can't, if you have any kind of heart or soul at all, you can't look at that and be okay with it. And if you want to deflect to something else, if you want to pretend someone else is the problem, if you want to pretend somehow that Palestinians are the ones trying to commit genocide, then I don't know how to have any conversation with you. I really don't. The evidence is solid. It's documented by independent sources, by video, by audio, by the sheer number of deaths that we see. And again, there have been genocides before. The most notable one of the 20th century was the genocide against the Armenian people by the Turks, where between 1 and 1.5 million Armenians were killed and killed brutally. I would also point out, I mean, there have been other genocides in the 20th century and certainly previously. And maybe one reason this strikes so hard to me is because I'm Irish. My second home is Ireland. My family, I still have plenty of family. I probably have more cousins I'm closer to in Ireland than I do in this country. Sorry, American cousins. But I have a lot of cousins in Ireland that I love dearly. And we have land there still. We have trees we planted there. And the family goes way back. And what happened to the Irish was also an attempt at genocide. I mean, you can't look at it any other way, in my opinion. I mean, maybe I know there are differences of opinion about what happened in Ireland, but when you basically say, when you take land, forcibly remove land from Irish peasants and give it to invaders, you know, when you prevent Irish Catholics from speaking their language, again, from owning land, from even putting up signs in their native Gaelic, when you basically force them to live on such small holdings that all they can grow to survive is potatoes, and then you allow a potato famine to destroy the crop, and then you don't provide food aid. Yeah, it's another way of denying, another way to encourage starvation. Just, you know, even as the Irish are dying from hunger because the potato famine is taking their primary source of food, exports, crops are being exported from wealthier land in Ireland to England and beyond. So I think what happened in Ireland was an attempted genocide. It failed. And I think it will also, I think the genocide that Israel is trying to enact against the Palestinian people will also fail. The Turks failed to exterminate the Armenians. They now have their own country. Hitler failed to exterminate the Jews. They now have their own country, and I hope that they will begin to share it peacefully with the Palestinian people who have also been there a long, long time. Again, I don't know if I'll ever get to any kind of consensus or agreement with my friends who are self-described Zionists, but I think it's worth trying, and maybe it's worth trying again, but not going in expecting that conversation was beyond jarring. Anyway, I as this goes forward, we're going to see more and more leaders, popes, religious leaders, nations, Jewish authorities on genocide, and other authorities on genocide stepping forward and saying, hey, that's what this is. It must stop. And you know, it's destroying the Palestinian people, but it won't wipe them out. They will survive. Who it will hurt more than anyone are the Jewish people and the state of Israel. The state of Israel is losing all credibility right now, all credibility. And that is only going to change when their policy toward their neighbors changes. I got to take a short break, folks. Back in a minute with more conversation. Ed Fallon with you on the Fallon Forum.
Thanks to Central Iowa realtor Joe Henry. Residential, commercial, land, Joe Henry's been covering all that for 23 years. He's also a leading community activist and a strong advocate for locally owned businesses like Ritual Cafe in downtown Des Moines. Call Joe Henry at 515-208-7312. That's 515-208-7312. You're responsible for a lot, and it's easy to become overwhelmed, to feel helpless, even hopeless. What's not so easy is finding your way back to feeling and functioning better. Psychiatrist Dr. David Drake helps individuals and couples throughout Iowa with the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling. Dr. Drake also prescribes medication when needed, and his services are offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. If you need help, don't delay. Contact Dr. Drake at daviddrakefamilypsychiatry.com.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks to our partners, including psychiatrist Dr. David Drake. If you live in Iowa, wherever you live in Iowa, Dr. Drake can help through the convenience and privacy of televideo counseling offered on a self-pay, negotiated fee basis. Contact David Drake, familypsychiatry.com. Thanks also to the Catholic Peace Ministry, whose focus is on nuclear disarmament. The situation in Gaza, the war in Ukraine, and the need to end the permanent war economy. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com. So I got a bunch of things I want to just run through quickly here, folks. Carbon dioxide pipelines. I don't know quite where this is going to go, but in North Dakota, there are two lawsuits against Summit Carbon Solutions that have now been brought together. I don't know what that means. I'll just be honest with you. I'm not sure how that plays out. I do know that I think Summit is on the ropes here. What happened in Iowa? Both chambers of the legislature passed a bill dealing with the eminent domain element of building these pipelines, and the governor vetoed it. And boy, did she tick off a lot of people, including one of the key House members, Bobby Kaufman, who is, you know, who's been a leader in trying to craft eminent domain legislation to deal with these kinds of situations. And he said, you know, we're not going anywhere with legislation, with budget bills next year until we address this. So we'll see what happens. But right now it's still in limbo. I can't imagine that Summit is not losing tons of money on this. Anyway, there is one other possibility, by the way, here in Iowa, that the legislature might come back into special session to override the governor's veto. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the House is willing to do it. I think there are enough friends of the governor and the Summit, the pipeline company, in the Senate where they won't let that happen. So we'll see what happens. I mean, it's still a crapshoot, but again, I think the momentum is with the people opposed to having their land taken for this purpose. Speaking of land, floods, Texas. I don't know what else to add about Texas. Horrible. Yeah, they could use a better warning system, and maybe you don't want to have your camps located by the rivers anymore in the new climate era when so much rain happens. And just rain, gosh, the last 2 days here in Des Moines, we've had 3 torrential downpours in like less than 48 hours. One of them wasn't even on the radar. I mean, literally, it starts pouring out. I look at the radar, nothing. The storm got ahead of the radar, got ahead of the National Weather Service. And I don't know how many inches we've had, but our rivers now are really high. And, you know, back in March, I was predicting this would be a flood year. And we'll see. We haven't quite got to that point yet where there's massive flooding, but the way it's looking, it could happen. So education. So I'm just going to run through a bunch of things on my mind here, folks. Education, K-12 schools. So the Republican Congress, with the blessing of President Trump, is withholding. Actually, I guess I would say that the onus is really on Trump, withholding $6.8 million for 7 grant programs. Is that a million or a billion? Anyway, they're withholding a ton of money from 7 grant programs that support teacher training. They support after-school programs and English learners. That's probably the problem, right? If you're learning English, then you shouldn't be in this country, I guess. So, and the reason given why they were withholding that money was to an ongoing programmatic review. And then the real reason, to root out a radical left-wing agenda. Gosh. So let's make kids suffer because of your perspective on what is the radical left-wing agenda. So on July 18th, just last week, the Trump administration told states they would start receiving what's called Title IV-B money for these after-school programs. That they would start receiving that today, the day I'm recording this program. And by the way, it was $6.8 billion, sorry. That effectively unfroze $1.4 billion, but still leaves $5 billion frozen. So three Republicans that I'm coming to admire, Susan Collins, Mitch McConnell, never thought I'd say that, and Jeanne Shaheen from New Hampshire, they have already urged the Trump administration to release the funds. We'll see what happens. But again, you know, I'm sorry you're so upset about wokeness, Mr. President, but don't take it out on the kids, all right? ICE. I want to talk about ICE. There was an ICE raid in MacArthur Park, Los Angeles. You remember the Donna Summer song, MacArthur Park is Melting? Don't know what that means, but apparently earlier this month, about 90 National Guard troops and dozens of federal agents, they just, boom, showed up at the park one morning. And the park was nearly empty because somehow the word of the potential raid had gotten out there. And L.A. Mayor Karen Bass, who's been, you know, a kind of a beacon of sanity in a lot of this crazy stuff happening there, pulled over on her way to City Hall to watch the officers on horseback and soldiers in tactical gear walking past a playground as children at a summer day camp were rushed indoors so they would not be traumatized. I mean, what the heck is this all about? Well, the bottom line is nobody really knows. Maybe the troops and officers, left in about an hour, and there's been no response as to what this was all about. I mean, it just seems like it's all part of instilling fear. Trump instills fear in people, in this case, immigrants and people living in neighborhoods with a high percentage of immigrants. He instills fear in the media, who cancel Stephen Colbert and pay him millions of bucks, even when they know that they wouldn't lose in court. It instills fear in universities, and then presidents either resign or ditch their DEI initiatives. So it's all about fear. And so is the alligator Alcatraz in Florida. It's about scaring you to think that, you know, we are so bad, so horrible. We're so tough, let's say. We're so tough that you don't ever want to end up at alligator Alcatraz. So it's an immigrant detention center in Florida. It's been called vile, inhumane, and gross. And in last week, Democratic members of Congress toured the facility. Now, I know that as a former Democratic lawmaker, I was able to, under the Constitution of our state, I was able to tour any Iowa prison at any reasonable hour. That was the language in the Constitution. And I was able to visit any prisoner when I was there. So apparently, the congressional Democrats were previously prevented from entering the detention center altogether, but they were allowed to visit once they had given notice. Once they were told that it's okay for you to come now, we'll hide the bad stuff, you know. And so, it's just, the things they're seeing there, it's just incredible. We're talking about there are 1,000 male detainees, mostly Hispanic. There are 32 people per cage. They're called cages, I guess. 6 cages in one tent. This isn't how you treat people, even prisoners. This is how you treat animals, and you shouldn't even treat animals like that. Yeah. And, one of the members of Congress was Maxwell Frost. He's a Democrat from Florida. He said, you know, he's a son of a Cuban. He said, people here look like me. I don't know, this alligator Alcatraz, I hope it's dismantled someday. Actually, maybe I hope it's left up as an example to how far we fell during the Trump years. Hey, got to take a short break. Back in a minute with more conversation. Di Finley's going to join me. We're going to be talking about elder care and Medicaid.
Catholic Peace Ministry is an independent nonprofit guided by an ecumenical board representing many faith traditions. Founded in 1980, Catholic Peace Ministry focuses on nuclear disarmament and ending the wars between Israel and Hamas and Russia and Ukraine. CPM's overarching concern is the need to end the permanent war economy, which must be challenged if we are to achieve lasting peace and justice. Learn more at CatholicPeaceMinistry.com.
At Westrom Optometry, Dr. Joel Westrom and his team provide a variety of services, including comprehensive eye exams, children's eye exams, and LASIK co-management. Whether strictly utilitarian or a fashion statement, your comfort and vision are Westrom's primary concern. Dr. Westrom and his staff will work closely with you to determine the best solution for your eyes, prescription, and lifestyle. Services are provided in English and Spanish, and the clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry, located in Des Moines East Village.
Welcome back to the Fallon Forum. Ed Fallon with you here, folks. Hey, thanks to our partners and sponsors, including Westrom Optometry. Dr. Joel Westrom and his staff are fluent in English and Spanish. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. and on Saturdays by appointment. That's Westrom Optometry. Thanks also to Ritual Cafe. Ritual is known for its fair trade coffee and tea. The cafe serves breakfast and lunch and an entirely vegetarian menu. Ritual Cafe is located on 13th Street in downtown Des Moines between Grand Ave and Locust Street. Hey, I'd like to welcome to the program Di Finley, who I've known a long, long time. She's the Executive Director of Iowa Caregivers and a longtime advocate for direct care workers and the people who direct care workers serve. Di, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to see you.
So the big budget bill. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to call it names or call it by preferred name by the Trump administration. But it's a big bill. It does a lot of things, including cut Medicaid. And we've had a lot of discussion about how that might affect, you know, low-income people generally or working people generally. But in your realm of somebody working working with the elderly and other constituents that are served by Iowa's caregivers, I mean, how do you see Medicaid affecting that universe?
Well, I think there's so many frightening facets to the bill and the cuts to Medicaid, because it does impact certainly older Iowans who are residents in nursing homes, people with disabilities who may be on waiver programs or are living in residential care facilities, children with special needs. It's just so far-reaching, but I think the other audience that people don't think about are those who actually serve those populations, and those would be the direct care workers that we advocate for. Mm. Many of them, too, rely on Medicaid for their health care coverage. So it's just so far-reaching.
Just as a snapshot, do you have any idea how many direct care workers there are in Iowa?
Yeah, we get asked that all the time, and because there is infrastructure that doesn't exist that should, that would give us more accurate numbers. Mm. But the best guesstimate that we have is between 45 and 60,000. So it's a huge number of folks.
And how will they be affected by the Medicaid portion of the budget bill?
Well, in 2019, we partnered with Workforce Development to do a direct care worker wage and benefits survey. And it was a bit of a departure from what they typically do. They generally collect their wage data from employers. And in this instance, they actually surveyed the direct care workers themselves.
What a novel idea.
Thank you.
I can't believe that one wasn't considered earlier, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, we were very excited about it. And yeah, it certainly does provide a different perspective. And just to give you an example, like one of the questions was, does your employer, they ask employers whether they offer direct health care coverage for their employees. And, you know, over 90% of employers do. But if you ask the direct care workers whether they actually have health care coverage, then you get somewhat of a different response.
And what percentage would that?
Well, I don't have them all memorized, but I did go back in and glance, and that was, again, 2019. I hope things have changed. But at that time, there was 10% had no health care coverage from any source, and about 25% relied on Medicaid. The Iowa Health and Wellness Plan.
While working in the healthcare field.
Exactly.
Yeah, I've heard that before. That, you know, you can be working in the finest hospital in the U.S. and still not be able to qualify. I mean, not be able to access the services there if you should need them.
Exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, So you're saying that maybe the numbers from the workers themselves are more reliable in terms of how many are currently, you know, on some kind of an adequate health care plan. And apparently, again, trusting the workers themselves, and again, in Iowa alone, 45 to 60,000, we're looking at about 20, 30% that, or maybe more, that might be on Medicaid?
Do math, Ed.
Well, you and me both.
Let's just say it's a significant portion of the population, most likely. But I will say that in 2025, we're partnering with Workforce Development again to repeat that survey.
Okay.
So we'll have some new current data that we can then do some comparison.
And that'll be available for the next legislative session.
Well, hopefully. Okay. It's been disseminated, and we're planning on a forum in the fall, but we haven't really set a date because we don't know exactly when that final report will be available, but sometime in November, we hope. That's the goal.
I'm guessing that a lot of the people who will eventually be impacted by cuts to Medicaid don't know it yet. They aren't aware of how this is going to affect them, and rightfully so, they may not know. We don't know how this is going to roll out.
No, and you raise a very good point, because I just learned, it was a kind of an eye-opener, kind of jaw-dropping for me to find out in talking to, and just a couple of direct care workers, they did not know that being on the Iowa Health and Wellness Plan was a Medicaid-supported program. Hmm. So they don't know that their health care coverage may be at risk. And that was verified. I mean, we had some conversations with some folks at Health and Human Services, and there is confusion out there about what their coverage actually is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so in terms of answering the questionnaire this year, their answers still won't be relevant to how the Medicaid cuts roll out. They'll still be speaking from their current experience.
Yes.
And the question is, well, how will that differ from what you learned in 2019? And do you have any expectation as to what that might look like?
Well, we're hopeful that it might show some increases in wages, but I'm not overly optimistic, because we put together a wage brief, I think we released it in 2004, and we did get the most recent labor market information at that time to do some comparison. There are some variables that are a little different, so it's not a true comparison, but based on that labor market information and what we collected in 2019, the median hourly wage was between $14 and $15 an hour. And in 2022, that was the most recent labor market information that they had, the wages had barely budged.
Hmm. Now, some are saying that the various elements of the budget bill, but especially perhaps the Medicaid portion, are going to have an inordinate and negative impact on rural communities, rural hospitals. And what is that prediction based on?
Well, that is a good question. I don't know that I'm the best person to answer that, but I would agree. And just based on, again, conversations, forums, you know, input that we've heard from people in rural communities, our Rural Health Association and others that are doing a lot of work around this issue. It is very frightening, and we're already seeing, and it's my understanding anyway, and again, I'm not an expert in Medicaid by any means, but that the hospital-based skilled nursing homes, for example, rely more on Medicare than they do Medicaid. Mm. And so that may have some impact just on the financial aspect of those hospitals being at risk and having to close some of their services.
Plenty of confusion in the world about the differences between Medicare and Medicaid, but Medicare, which again kicks in when you're 65, is not being affected by this bill, as I understand it?
That's what I understand, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I do know is that when you do hit 65, if you are on Medicaid, you get bumped off Medicaid.
Oh, I did not know that.
I can speak from experience on that.
Okay.
You know, you get bumped off Medicaid, and the service, the level of service provided through Medicare is much, much lower. There are higher deductibles, more copays, less services are covered. Medicaid is really universal health care, but for a very distinct audience.
Mm-hmm, right.
And I think that's why, you know, Bernie Sanders and others have called for Medicaid for all, mm-hmm. not Medicare for all, because again, it almost seems like the Medicare was designed with the intent of making sure that the insurance industry continued to make a heck of a lot of money. You know?
Imagine.
Imagine that, yeah. Yeah. So when people say that rural areas are going to be hit particularly hard, again, because rural hospitals are already struggling. Or care in rural areas is already a difficult service to access. And so, you know, and some find there to be some irony there, because most rural communities supported President Trump and probably didn't support seeing, you know, direct care workers in their hospitals and clinics laid off. They didn't see low-income or even full-time working people who are on Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't see them losing coverage. So I wonder any sense of what the response is going to be in rural communities when they start seeing that, yeah, there's a direct impact on us, our way of life, and our community from these cuts in the budget bill.
Well, I think we've already heard from some that it's been eye-opening. Again, some of those folks that don't realize that their coverage, you know, can be impacted. But if you don't mind, I like to go back to another aspect of the rural
mm-hmm.
Issue and nursing homes. I know you have concern about the elder care or care for older Iowans, and you know how many nursing homes have closed too. In the state over the past well, the last I looked, somewhere between 40 and 50.
Out of how many older?
Over 400. But
so 10% have closed.
Yeah.
See, I'm not so bad at math.
No, I'm impressed. I am impressed.
Oh, that was an easy one. Throw me a harder number.
Yeah. But the other rural aspect of this is we've heard from family caregivers who, you know, when nursing homes are closed, what a huge burden that is, whether the state comes in and closes them or they're closing because of financial issues, whatever. They'd rather have an understaffed nursing facility in their community than have to relocate their loved one.
Because that care then will fall on them, and they may be ill-equipped and even totally incapable of providing care.
Right, because family caregivers are getting older, too, because, you know, people are living longer. So, How dare we? But it is devastating, yeah. I think, for those families to...
So when you said you've been hearing things already, what have you been hearing in terms of rural residents who are concerned about the direction we're heading?
Well... Just what we've already talked about,
okay.
Ed, right. Is the lack of coverage, reducing services and support for low-income people and the workforce. I mean, if we're using workforce, and that's what we're hearing from providers, is that they can't even find the workforce to keep their organizations open and provide the care, then...
Now, when I was a legislator, one of my two best friends up at the State House, Bill Witt, sat next to me for many years. And in addition to, you know, working a lot on the environment, he was very active on elder care.
Yep.
and seem to be able to make some progress to find some common ground with the Republican majority. And is that still the case, where there may be some bipartisan cooperation on trying to address some of the concerns? Be honest with me.
Well, I am.
Okay.
That's all I know how to do.
Good.
They've not, we have not seen a lot of bipartisanship on these issues. And I remember Bill, and I know he did a lot of work around working with providers, especially nursing home providers, and trying to increase reimbursement
yeah.
rates. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all for increasing reimbursement rates. We think providers need to be reimbursed, you know, appropriately so they can pay their people what they deserve. But at the same time, we also feel that there needs to be some accountability built into mm-hmm. legislation. If that's what we're saying those dollars are going to be used for, then there needs to be some way of making sure that's where it ends up. And there mm-hmm. have been instances where there have been efforts along those lines, but then it hasn't ended up in the pockets of the people.
So is the Democratic majority in the House and Senate pretty much on board with some of the changes you'd like to see implemented?
Well, you know, I had a legislator ask me before session, is the state doing enough to address direct care workforce issues? And I mean, I just had to think, you know, I've been at this for 33 years, Ed, and if the state was doing enough, we would not still be having the same conversations today that we were having 33 years ago, sadly.
And do you see the Republican majority is willing to talk with you on implementing some of these changes?
Some, yes. Some. Yeah, we've had some good conversations with the chair of the HHS, okay. the new chair, Senator Klemisch.
Okay.
So yeah, we've had good conversations on both sides of the aisle. Well, I'm just hope.
Well, I imagine it'll be a good issue to raise in the governor's race as well.
Oh yeah.
Well, Di, thank you so much for joining us, folks. We've been talking with Di Finley, with the Iowa Direct Care Workers, and going to take a short break here. Again, Ed Fallon with you, with the Fallon Forum. We're going to come back. Kathy Burns will join me. We're going to be talking about the recent Hunger Summit sponsored by the World Food Prize. Back in a moment on the Fallon Forum. Architecture by Synthesis provides planning, design, and design build services for high performance, low maintenance, affordable homes and buildings. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. That's architecturebysynthesis.com.
At Story County Veterinary Clinic, Dr. Kim Holding has over 30 years of experience working with all creatures, great and small. Cat, dog, horse, cow, elephant. Well, if you've got a pet elephant, you may be in trouble. Kim's clients stick with her year after year because they know she'll do right by them and their pets and farm animals. So give Kim a shout to keep your animals happy and healthy. Call 515-232-8766. That's 232-8766.
All right, let's get back to it, shall we? And thanks to our sponsors, including Story County Veterinary Clinic, where Dr. Kim Holding has been caring for all creatures, great and small, for over 30 years. Learn more at Story County Veterinary Clinic's Facebook page. Thanks also to Architecture by Synthesis. Owner Mark Clipsham asks that you use the most energy-efficient methods you can afford and the greenest, longest-lasting materials available. Examples of Mark's work can be found at architecturebysynthesis.com. Hey, Kathy, welcome to the program. Last week, you spent an entire day at the Iowa Hunger Summit.
I will admit, I didn't do the entire day. I had to leave after the luncheon. Okay. But it was jam-packed with information. I felt like I got a full day's worth of, you know, new insight into hunger in Iowa and across the U.S.,
This is sponsored by the World Food Prize, which is headquartered here in Iowa. It's kind of the World Food Prize is kind of the food prize of Nobel Peace Prize stuff, you know.
It is. Yeah. It is, and a lot of people don't know that Des Moines is the home of that prestigious organization. The World Food Prize Foundation sponsored the Iowa Hunger Summit, and it's a cool building, actually. It's the original Des Moines Public Library,
right.
And it's been reconfigured as the Hall of Laureates.
Meaning the hall of those who've won the prize in the past.
The hall of one, yeah. And it seems like that space goes by so many different names, it's kind of hard to pin down sometimes.
So did you have a good meal at the Iowa Hunger Summit?
Oh, okay. Well, let's start with that. I learned a lot. I didn't eat a lot at the Iowa Hunger Summit. And, you know, I guess that was good for me emotionally. But the agenda indicated that during the registration time period, and there would be booths set up outside in the main area, there would be a light breakfast provided, and it was half pint containers of yogurt. So I had one of those, and people who know me know that I try to take good care of my blood sugar, so yeah. It was very light, and I got very hungry before the conference started, and then I had another little yogurt. And then I will say I had to run out and find some food.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. Kathy's blood sugar is such that if she doesn't eat, she collapses.
I do. I do. Well, it's not pretty.
No.
And Ed suffers for it.
Yeah, that's right. So anyway, what was your impression of the presentations?
Well, the theme this year was hunger from the ground up, and it traced the hunger issues from pre-birth and just newly post-birth up to the elder population. So that was an interesting way to build the conversations.
Yeah, because when you say hunger from the ground up, I assume they're talking about food growing by plants.
And this was about availability and distribution.
So nothing about production.
But it may have been touched on as a side issue. It's okay. Possible it was discussed more in the afternoon sessions, which I did miss.
Yeah, okay.
One of the nice features of this, because this was about from the ground up and it involved school-age children, the luncheon did feature a school lunch theme. So we had little trays and they put, you know, a tortilla and some meat and veggies and things on there. And you could choose between chocolate and white milk or juice. So in the little
chocolate
containers.
And vanilla milk.
One of the things I was most impressed with was the recipient of the Iowa Shares Humanitarian Award, Anne McGlynn. She's the founder and director of Tapestry Farms in the Quad Cities area. Shares means Iowa sends help to aid refugees and end starvation. Hmm. So the yearly award honors an individual or organization that's shown leadership in alleviating hunger. And this is in honor of former Iowa Governor Robert Ray, who paved the way for refugees to come to the state.
So I'm almost surprised that that perspective didn't get criticized from the Trump administration or some of Iowa's congressional members who support everything that Trump does.
Governor Branstad was there to help present, to be in the photo,
right.
To present the award. And
but not Governor Reynolds.
Former Governor Branstad, correct, because right. He is the former CEO of the Iowa, or the World Food Prize Foundation as well. McGlynn was amazing at telling her story of learning that there were refugees coming into her neighborhood, to her area, and she started developing systems to make food, homegrown local food available to them, and it grew into a full-fledged food and assistance program. Mm. And she was very inspirational.
So did this gathering have a sponsor?
Well, there were numerous sponsors. And one thing that I was surprised about was, and you know, I don't know all the rationale behind it, but during one of the panel discussions, there were two women there who were representing the Women, Infants, and Children program, a nursing peer and a breastfeeding peer and a nutrition expert. But the other person involved in that panel was the e-commerce director for Hy-Vee Incorporated, and she was explaining the pilot program, a partnership between WIC and Hy-Vee to make available online shopping and curbside pickup to people on the WIC program. And I thought, well, it's a great system. I hope more stores get it, because otherwise Hy-Vee has cornered the market on all the WIC money.
Yeah. Hmm. Hey, thanks, Kathy. Thanks to our guests today, Di Finley, and to our production team of Sherry Herdina, Forrest Dederman, Charles Goldman, Kathy, and myself, Ed Fallon. Thanks also to our local small business partners, Gateway Marketing Cafe, Story County Veterinary Clinic, Westrum Optometry, David Drake Family Psychiatry, real estate agent Joe Henry, Ritual Cafe, and Architecture by Synthesis. Thanks also to our nonprofit partners, Catholic Peace Ministry, Iowa Physicians for Social Responsibility, Bold Iowa, Birds and Bees Urban Farm, and Climate March. And finally, thanks to the Des Moines Iver Session for our bumper music. We'll be back next week with another hour of cutting-edge talk radio.